Apart from the question whether man is really so glorious as the theologians of evolution say he is, there is the further difficulty that life on this planet is almost certainly temporary. The Earth will grow cold, or the atmosphere will gradually fly off, or there will be an insufficiency of water, or, as Sir James Jeans genially prophesizes, the sun will burst and all the planets will be turned into gas. Which of those will happen first, no one knows, but in any case the human race will ultimately die out. Of course, such an event is of little importance from the point of view of orthodox theology, since men are immortal, and will continue to exist in heaven and hell when none are left on earth. But in that case, why bother about terrestrial developments? Those who lay stress on the gradual progress from the primitive slime to man attach an importance to this mundane sphere which should make them shrink from the conclusion that all life on earth is only a brief interlude between the nebula and the eternal frost, or perhaps between one nebula and another. The importance of man, which is the one indispensable dogma of the theologians, receives no support from a scientific view of the future of the solar system. There are many other sources of false belief besides self-importance. One of these is love of the marvelous. I knew at one time a scientifically minded conjurer who used to perform his tricks before a small audience and then get them, each separately, to write down what they had seen happen. Almost always, they wrote down something much more astonishing than the reality, and usually something which no conjurer could have achieved. Yet they all thought they were reporting truly what they had seen with their own eyes. This sort of falsification is still more true of rumors. A tells B that last night he saw Mr. the eminent prohibitionist slightly the worse for liquor. B tells C that A saw the good man reeling drunk. C tells D that he was picked up unconscious in the ditch. D tells E that he is well known to pass out every evening. Here, it is true, another motive comes in, namely malice. We like to think ill of our neighbors, and are prepared to believe the worst on very little evidence. But even where there is no such motive, what is marvelous is readily believed, unless it goes against some strong prejudice. All history until the 18th century is full of prodigies and wonders, which modern historians ignore. Not because they are less well attested than facts which the historians accept, but because modern taste among the learned prefers what science regards as probable. Shakespeare relates how on the night before Caesar was killed, a common slave, you know him well by sight, held up his left hand, which did flame and burn like 20 torches joined, and yet his hand, not sensible of fire, remained unscorched. Besides, I have not since put up my sword against the capital. I met a lion who glared upon me and went surely by, without annoying me, and there were drawn upon a heap 100 ghastly women, transformed with their fear, who swore they saw men, all in fire, walk up and down the streets. Shakespeare did not invent these marvels. He found them in reputable historians, who are among those upon whom we depend for our knowledge concerning Julius Caesar. This sort of thing always used to happen at the death of a great man, or the beginning of an important war. Even so recently as 1914, the Angels of Mons encouraged the British troops. The evidence for such events is very seldom first-hand, and modern historians refuse to accept it, except, of course, where the event is one that has religious importance. Every powerful emotion has its own myth-making tendency. When the emotion is peculiar to an individual, he is considered more or less mad if he gives credence to such myths as he has invented. But when an emotion is collective, as in war, there is no one to correct the myths that naturally arise. Consequently, in all times of great collective excitement, unfounded rumors obtain wide credence. In September 1914, almost everybody in England believed that Russian troops had passed through England on the way to the Western Front. Everybody knew someone who had seen them, though no one had seen them himself. This myth-making faculty is often allied with cruelty. Ever since the Middle Ages, the Jews have been accused of practicing ritual murder. There is not an iota of evidence for this accusation, and no sane person who has examined it believes it. Nevertheless, it persists. I have met white Russians who were convinced of its truth, and, among many Nazis, it is accepted without question. Such myths give an excuse for the infliction of torture, and the unfounded belief in them is evidence of the unconscious desire to find some victim to persecute. There was, until the end of the 18th century, a theory that insanity is due to possession by devils. It was inferred that any pain suffered by the patient is also suffered by the devils, so that the best cure is to make the patient suffer so much that the devils would decide to abandon him. The insane, in accordance with this theory, were savagely beaten. This treatment was tried on King George III when he was mad, but without success. It is a curious and painful fact that almost all the completely futile treatments that have been believed in during the long history of medical folly have been such as caused acute suffering to the patient. When anesthetics were discovered, pious people considered them an attempt to evade the will of God. It was pointed out, however, that when God extracted Adam's rib, he put him into a deep sleep. This proved that anesthetics are all right for men. Women, however, ought to suffer because of the curse of Eve. In the West, votes for women proved this doctrine mistaken, but in Japan to this day, women in childbirth are not allowed any alleviation through anesthetics. As the Japanese do not believe in Genesis, this piece of sadism must have some other justification. The fallacies about race and blood, which have always been popular, and which the Nazis have embodied in their official creed, have no objective justification. They are believed solely because they minister to self-esteem and to the impulse towards cruelty. In one form or another, these beliefs are as old as civilization. Their forms change, but their essence remains. Herodotus tells how Cyrus was brought up by peasants, in complete ignorance of his royal blood. At the age of 12, his kingly bearing toward other peasant boys revealed the truth. This is a variant of an old story which is found in all Indo-European countries. Even quite modern people say that blood will tell. It is no use for scientific physiologists to assure the world that there is no difference between the blood of a Negro and the blood of a white man. The American Red Cross, in obedience to popular prejudice, at first when America became involved in the present war, decreed that no Negro blood should be used for blood transfusion. As a result of an agitation, it was conceded that Negro blood might be used, but only for Negro patients. Similarly, in Germany, the Aryan soldier who needs blood transfusion is carefully protected from the contamination of Jewish blood. In the matter of race, there are different beliefs in different societies. Where monarchy is firmly established, kings are of a higher race than their subjects. Until very recently, it was universally believed that men are congenitally more intelligent than women. Even so enlightened a man as Spinoza decides against votes for women on this ground. Among white men, it is held that white men are by nature superior to men of other colors, and especially to black men. In Japan, on the contrary, it is thought that yellow is the best color. In Haiti, when they make statues of Christ and Satan, they make Christ black and Satan white. Aristotle and Plato considered Greeks so innately superior to barbarians that slavery is justified so long as the master is Greek and the slave barbarian. The Nazis and the American legislators who made the immigration laws consider the Nordics superior to Slavs or Latins or any other white men. But the Nazis, under the stress of war, have been led to the conclusion that there are hardly any true Nordics outside Germany. The Norwegians, except Quisling and his few followers, have been corrupted by intermixture with Finns and Laps and such. Thus, politics are a clue to dissent. The biologically pure Nordic loves Hitler, and if you do not love Hitler, that is proof of tainted blood. All this is, of course, pure nonsense, known to be such by everyone who has studied the subject. In schools in America, children of the most diverse origins are subjected to the same educational system, and those whose business it is to measure intelligence quotients and otherwise estimate the native ability of students are unable to make any such racial distinctions as are postulated by the theorists of race. In every national or racial group, there are clever children and stupid children, It is not likely that, in the United States, colored children would develop as successfully as white children, because of the stigma of social inferiority. But insofar as congenital ability can be detached from environmental influence, there is no clear distinction among different groups. The whole conception of superior races is merely a myth generated by the overweening self-esteem of the holders of power. It may be that, someday, better evidence will be forthcoming. Perhaps, in time, educators will be able to prove, say, that Jews are on the average more intelligent than Gentiles. But as yet, no such evidence exists, and all talk of superior races must be dismissed as nonsense. There is a special absurdity in applying racial theories to the various populations of Europe. There is not in Europe any such thing as a pure race. Russians have an admixture of Tatar blood. Germans are largely Slavonic. France is a mixture of Celts, Germans, and people of Mediterranean race. Italy the same, with the addition of the descendants of slaves imported by the Romans. The English are perhaps the most mixed of all. There is no evidence that there is any advantage in belonging to a pure race. The purest races now in existence are the Pygmies, the Hottentots, and the Australian Aborigines. The Tasmanians, who were probably even purer, are extinct. They were not the bearers of a brilliant culture. The ancient Greeks, on the other hand, emerged from an amalgamation of northern barbarians and an indigenous population. The Athenians and Ionians, who were the most civilized, were also the most mixed. The supposed merits of racial purity are, it would seem, wholly imaginary. Superstitions about blood have many forms that have nothing to do with race. The objection to homicide seems to have been originally based on the ritual pollution caused by the blood of the victim. God said to Cain, "The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground." According to some anthropologists, the mark of Cain was a disguise to prevent Abel's blood from finding him. This appears also to be the original reason for wearing mourning. In many ancient communities, no difference was made between murder and accidental homicide. In either case, equally ritual ablution was necessary. The feeling that blood defiles still lingers, for example, in the churching of women and in taboos connected with menstruation. The idea that a child is of his father's blood has the same superstitious origin. So far as actual blood is concerned, the mother's enters into the child, but not the father's. If blood were as important as is supposed, matriarchy would be the only proper way of tracing descent. In Russia, where, under the influence of Karl Marx, people since the revolution have been classified by their economic origin, difficulties have arisen not unlike those of German race theorists over the Scandinavian Nordics. There were two theories that had to be reconciled. On the one hand, proletarians were good, and other people were bad. On the other hand, communists were good, and other people were bad. The only way of effecting a reconciliation was to alter the meaning of words. A proletarian came to mean a supporter of the government. Lenin, though born a prince, was reckoned a member of the proletariat. On the other hand, the word kulak, which was supposed to mean a rich peasant, came to mean any peasant who opposed collectivization. This sort of absurdity always arises when one group of human beings is supposed to be inherently better than another. In America, the highest praise that can be bestowed on an eminent colored man after he is safely dead is to say, "He was a white man." A courageous woman is called masculine. Macbeth, praising his wife's courage, says, "Bring forth men children only, for thy undaunted metal should compose nothing but males." All these ways of speaking come of unwillingness to abandon foolish generalizations. In the economic sphere, there are many widespread superstitions. Why do people value gold and precious stones? Not simply because of their rarity. There are a number of elements called rare earths, which are much rarer than gold. But no one will give a penny for them, except a few men of science. There is a theory, for which there is much to be said, that gold and gems were valued originally on account of their supposed magical properties. The mistakes of governments in modern times seems to show that this belief still exists among the sort of men who are called practical. At the end of the last war, It was agreed that Germany should pay vast sums to England and France, and they in turn should pay vast sums to the United States. Everyone wanted to be paid in money rather than goods. The practical men failed to notice that there is not that amount of money in the world. They also failed to notice that money is no use unless it is used to buy goods. As they would not use it in this way, it did no good to anyone. There was supposed to be some mystic virtue about gold that made it worthwhile to dig it up in the Transvaal and put it underground again in bank vaults in America. In the end, of course, the debtor countries had no more money, and since they were not allowed to pay in goods, they went bankrupt. The Great Depression was the direct result of the surviving belief in the magical properties of gold. It is to be feared that some similar superstition will cause equally bad results after the end of the present war. Politics is largely governed by sententious platitudes which are devoid of truth. One of the most widespread popular maxims is, "Human nature cannot be changed." No one can say whether this is true or not without first defining human nature. But as used, it is certainly false. When Mr. A. utters the maxim with an air of portentous and conclusive wisdom, what he means is that all men everywhere will always continue to behave as they do in his own hometown. A little anthropology will dispel this belief. Among the Tibetans, one wife has many husbands, because men are too poor to support a whole wife. Yet family life, according to travelers, is no more unhappy than elsewhere. The practice of lending one's wife to a guest is very common among uncivilized tribes. The Australian Aborigines at puberty undergo a very painful operation which, throughout the rest of their lives, greatly diminishes sexual potency. Infanticide, which might seem contrary to human nature, was almost universal before the rise of Christianity, and is recommended by Plato to prevent overpopulation. Private property is not recognized among some savage tribes. Even among highly civilized people, economic considerations will override what is called human nature. In Moscow, where there is an acute housing shortage, when an unmarried woman is pregnant, it often happens that a number of men contend for the legal right to be considered the father of the prospective child, because whoever is judged to be the father acquires the right to share the woman's room, and half a room is better than no room. In fact, adult human nature is extremely variable, according to the circumstances of education. Food and sex are very general requirements. But the hermits of the Thebaid eschewed sex altogether, and reduced food to the lowest point compatible with survival. By diet and training, people can be made ferocious or meek, masterful or slavish, as may suit the educator. There is no nonsense so arrant that it cannot be made the creed of the vast majority by adequate governmental action. Plato intended his republic to be founded on a myth, which he admitted to be absurd, but he was rightly confident that the populace could be induced to believe it. Hobbes, who thought it important that people should reverence the government, however unworthy it might be, meets the argument that it might be difficult to obtain general assent to anything so irrational by pointing out that people have been brought to believe in the Christian religion, and in particular in the dogma of transubstantiation. If he had been alive now, he would have found ample confirmation in the devotion of German youth to the Nazis. The power of governments over men's beliefs has been very great ever since the rise of large states. The great majority of Romans became Christian after the Roman emperors had been converted. In the parts of the Roman Empire that were conquered by the Arabs, most people abandoned Christianity for Islam. The division of Western Europe into Protestant and Catholic regions was determined by the attitude of governments in the 16th century. But the power of governments over belief in the present day is vastly greater than at any earlier time. A belief, however untrue, is important when it dominates the actions of large masses of men. In this sense, the beliefs inculcated by the Japanese, Russian, and German governments are important. Since they are completely divergent, they cannot all be true, though they may well all be false. Unfortunately, they are such as to inspire men with an ardent desire to kill one another, even to the point of almost completely inhibiting The impulse of self-preservation. No one can deny, in face of the evidence, that it is easy, given military power, to produce a population of fanatical lunatics. It would be equally easy to produce a population of sane and reasonable people. But many governments do not wish to do so, since such people would fail to admire the politicians who are at the head of these governments. There is one peculiarly pernicious application of the doctrine that human nature cannot be changed. This is the dogmatic assertion that there will always be wars, because we are so constituted that we feel in need of them. What is true is that a man who has had the kind of diet and education that most men have will wish to fight when provoked, but he will not actually fight unless he has a chance of victory. It is very annoying to be stopped by a speed cop, but we do not fight him because we know that he has the overwhelming forces of the state at his back. People who have no occasion for war do not make any impression of being psychologically thwarted. Sweden has had no war since 1814, but the Swedes were, a few years ago, one of the happiest and most contented nations in the world. I doubt whether they are so still, but that is because, though neutral, they are unable to escape many of the evils of war. If political organization were such as to make war obviously unprofitable, there is nothing in human nature that would compel its occurrence, or make average people unhappy because of its not occurring. Exactly the same arguments that are now used about the impossibility of preventing war were formerly used in defense of dueling, yet few of us feel thwarted because we are not allowed to fight duels. I am persuaded that there is absolutely no limit to the absurdities that can, by government action, come to be generally believed. Give me an adequate army, with power to provide it with more pay and better food than falls to the lot of the average man, and I will undertake, within 30 years, to make the majority of the population believe that 2 and 2 are 3, that water freezes when it gets hot and boils when it gets cold, or any other nonsense that might seem to serve the interest of the state. Of course, even when these beliefs have been generated, people would not put the kettle in the icebox when they wanted it to boil. That cold makes water boil would be a Sunday truth, sacred and mystical, to be professed in awed tones, but not to be acted on in daily life. What would happen would be that any verbal denial of the mystic doctrine would be made illegal, and obstinate heretics would be frozen at the stake. No person who did not enthusiastically accept the official doctrine would be allowed to teach or to have any position of power. Only the very highest officials, in their cups, would whisper to each other what rubbish it all is. Then they would laugh and drink again. This is hardly a caricature of what happens under some modern governments. The discovery that man can be scientifically manipulated and that governments can turn large masses this way or that as they choose is one of the causes of our misfortunes. There is as much difference between a collection of mentally free citizens and a community molded by modern methods of propaganda as there is between a heap of raw materials and a battleship. Education, which was at first made universal in order that all might be able to read and write, has been found capable of serving quite other purposes. By instilling nonsense, it unifies populations and generates collective enthusiasm. If all governments taught the same nonsense, the harm would not be so great. Unfortunately, each has its own brand, and the diversity serves to produce hostility between the devotees of different creeds. If there is ever to be peace in the world, governments will have to agree either to inculcate no dogmas, or all to inculcate the same. The former, I fear, is a utopian ideal, but perhaps they could agree to teach collectively that all public men, everywhere, are completely virtuous and perfectly wise. Perhaps when the war is over, the surviving politicians may find it prudent to combine on some such program. But if conformity has its dangers, so has nonconformity. Some advanced thinkers are of the opinion that anyone who differs from the conventional opinion must be in the right. This is a delusion. If it were not, truth would be easier to come by than it is. There are infinite possibilities of error, and more cranks take up unfashionable errors than unfashionable truths. I met once an electrical engineer whose first words to me were, "How do you do?" There are two methods of faith healing, the one practiced by Christ and the one practiced by most Christian scientists. I practice the method practiced by Christ. Shortly afterwards, he was sent to prison for making out fraudulent balance sheets. The law does not look kindly on the intrusion of faith into this region. I knew also an eminent lunacy doctor who took to philosophy and taught a new logic which, as he frankly confessed, he had learnt from his lunatics. When he died, he left a will founding a professorship for the teaching of his new scientific methods. But unfortunately, he left no assets. Arithmetic proved recalcitrant to lunatic logic. On one occasion, a man came to ask me to recommend some of my books, as he was interested in philosophy. I did so, but he returned next day saying that he had been reading one of them, and had found only one statement he could understand, and that one seemed to him false. I asked him what it was, and he said it was the statement that Julius Caesar is dead. When I asked him why he did not agree, he drew himself up and said, "Because I am Julius Caesar." These examples may suffice to show that you cannot make sure of being right by being eccentric. Science, which has always had to fight its way against popular beliefs, now has one of its most difficult battles in the sphere of psychology. People who think they know all about human nature are always hopelessly at sea when they have to do with any abnormality. Some boys never learn to be what, in animals, is called house-trained. The sort of person who won't stand any nonsense deals with such cases by punishment. The boy is beaten, and when he repeats the offence, he is beaten worse. All medical men who have studied the matter know that punishment only aggravates the trouble. Sometimes the cause is physical, but usually it is psychological, and only curable by removing some deep-seated and probably unconscious grievance. But most people enjoy punishing anyone who irritates them, and so the medical view is rejected as fancy nonsense. The same sort of thing applies to men who are exhibitionists. They are sent to prison over and over again, but as soon as they come out, they repeat the offence. A medical man who specialized in such ailments assured me that the exhibitionist can be cured by the simple device of having trousers that button up the back instead of the front. But this method is not tried because it does not satisfy people's vindictive impulses. Broadly speaking, punishment is likely to prevent crimes that are sane in origin, but not those that spring from some psychological abnormality. This is now partially recognized. We distinguish between plain theft, which springs from what may be called rational self-interest, and kleptomania, which is a mark of something queer. And homicidal maniacs are not treated like ordinary murderers. But sexual aberrations rouse so much disgust that it is still impossible to have them treated medically rather than punitively. Indignation, though on the whole a useful social force, becomes harmful when it is directed against the victims of maladies that only medical skill can cure. The same sort of thing happens as regards whole nations. During the last war, very naturally, people's vindictive feelings were aroused against the Germans, who were severely punished after their defeat. Now many people are arguing that the Versailles Treaty was ridiculously mild, since it failed to teach a lesson. This time, we are told, there must be real severity. To my mind, we shall be more likely to prevent a repetition of German aggression if we regard the rank and file of the Nazis as we regard lunatics, than if we think of them as merely and simply criminals. Lunatics, of course, have to be restrained. We do not allow them to carry firearms. Similarly, the German nation will have to be disarmed. But lunatics are restrained from prudence, not as a punishment, and so far as prudence permits, we try to make them happy. Everybody recognizes that a homicidal maniac will only become more homicidal if he is made miserable. In Germany at the present day, there are, of course, many men among the Nazis who are plain criminals, but there must also be many who are more or less mad. Leaving the leaders out of account, I do not urge leniency toward them. The bulk of the German nation is much more likely to learn cooperation with the rest of the world if it is subjected to a kind but firm curative treatment than if it is regarded as an outcast among the nations. Those who are being punished seldom learn to feel kindly toward the men who punish them. And so long as the Germans hate the rest of mankind, peace will be precarious. When one reads of the beliefs of savages, or of the ancient Babylonians and Egyptians, they seem surprising by their capricious absurdity. But beliefs that are just about as absurd are still entertained by the uneducated, even in the most modern and civilized societies. I have been gravely assured, in America, that people born in March are unlucky, and people born in May are peculiarly liable to corns. I do not know the history of these superstitions, but probably they are derived from Babylonian or Egyptian priestly love. Beliefs begin in the higher social strata, and then, like mud in a river, sink gradually downward in the educational scale. They may take 3,000 or 4,000 years to sink all the way. You may find your colored help making some remark that comes straight out of Plato. Not the parts of Plato that scholars quote, but the parts where he utters obvious nonsense. Such as, that men who do not pursue wisdom in this life will be born again as women. Commentators on great philosophers always politely ignore their silly remarks. Aristotle, in spite of his reputation, is full of absurdities. He says that children should be conceived in the winter, when the wind is in the north, and that if people marry too young, the children will be female. He tells us that the blood of females is blacker than that of males, that the pig is the only animal liable to measles, that an elephant suffering from insomnia should have its shoulders rubbed with salt, olive oil, and warm water, that women have fewer teeth than men, and so on. Nevertheless, he is considered by the great majority of philosophers a paragon of wisdom. Superstitions about lucky and unlucky days are almost universal. In ancient times, they governed the actions of generals. Among ourselves, the prejudice against Friday and the number 13 is very active. Sailors do not like to sail on Friday, and many hotels have no 13th floor. The superstitions about Friday and 13 were once believed by those reputed wise. Now such men regard them as harmless follies. But probably 2,000 years hence, many beliefs of the wise of our day will have come to seem equally foolish. Man is a credulous animal, and must believe something. In the absence of good grounds for belief, he will be satisfied with bad ones. Belief in nature and what is natural is a source of many errors. It used to be, and to some extent still is, powerfully operative in medicine. The human body, left to itself, has a certain power of curing itself. Small cuts usually heal, colds pass off, and even serious diseases sometimes disappear without medical treatment. But aids to nature are very desirable, even in these cases. Cuts may turn septic if not disinfected, colds may turn to pneumonia, and serious diseases are only left without treatment by explorers and travelers in remote regions who have no option. Many practices which have come to seem natural were originally unnatural, for instance, clothing and washing. Before men adopted clothing, they must have found it impossible to live in cold climates. Where there is not a modicum of cleanliness, populations suffer from various diseases, such as typhus, from which Western nations have become exempt. Vaccination was, and by some still is, objected to as unnatural. But there is no consistency in such objections, for no one supposes that a broken bone can be mended by natural behavior. Eating cooked food is unnatural. So is heating our houses. The Chinese philosopher Lao Tse, whose traditional date is about 600 BC, objected to roads and bridges and boats as unnatural, and in his disgust at such mechanistic devices left China and went to live among the Western barbarians. Every advance in civilization has been denounced as unnatural, while it was recent. The commonest objection to birth control is that it is against nature. For some reason, we are not allowed to say that celibacy is against nature. The only reason I can think of is that it is not new. Malthus saw only three ways of keeping down the population: moral restraint, vice, and misery. Moral restraint, he admitted, was not likely to be practiced on a large scale. Vice, i.e. birth control, he, as a clergyman, viewed with abhorrence. There remained misery. In his comfortable parsonage, he contemplated the misery of the great majority of mankind with equanimity, and pointed out the fallacies of reformers who hoped to alleviate it. Modern theological opponents of birth control are less honest. They pretend to think that God will provide, however many mouths there may be to feed. They ignore the fact that he has never done so hitherto, but has left mankind exposed to periodical famines in which millions died of hunger. They must be deemed to hold, if they are saying what they believe, that from this moment onward God will work a continual miracle of loaves and fishes which he has hitherto thought unnecessary. Or perhaps they will say that suffering here below is of no importance. What matters is the hereafter. By their own theology, most of the children whom their opposition to birth control will cause to exist will go to hell. We must suppose, therefore, that they oppose the amelioration of life on earth because they think it a good thing that many millions should suffer eternal torment. By comparison with them, Malthus appears merciful. Women, as the object of our strongest love and aversion, rouse complex emotions which are embodied in proverbial wisdom. Almost everybody allows himself or herself some entirely unjustifiable generalization on the subject of woman. Married men, when they generalize on that subject, judge by their wives, women judge by themselves. It would be amusing to write a history of men's views on women. In antiquity, when male supremacy was unquestioned and Christian ethics were still unknown, women were harmless but rather silly, and a man who took them seriously was somewhat despised. Plato thinks it a grave objection to the drama that the playwright has to imitate women in creating his female roles. With the coming of Christianity, women took on a new part, that of the temptress, but at the same time she was also found capable of being a saint. In Victorian days, the saint was much more emphasized than the temptress. Victorian men could not admit themselves susceptible to temptation. The superior virtue of women was made a reason for keeping them out of politics, where, it was held, a lofty virtue is impossible. But the early feminists turned the argument round and contended that the participation of women would ennoble politics. Since this has turned out to be an illusion, there has been less talk of women's superior virtue, but there are still a number of men who adhere to the monkish view of woman as the temptress. Women themselves, for the most part, think of themselves as the sensible sex, whose business it is to undo the harm that comes of men's impetuous follies. For my part, I distrust all generalizations about women, favorable and unfavorable, masculine and feminine. Ancient and modern, all alike, I should say, result from paucity of experience. The deeply irrational attitude of each sex toward women may be seen in novels, particularly in bad novels. In bad novels by men, there is the woman with whom the author is in love, who usually possesses every charm, but is somewhat helpless, and requires male protection. Sometimes, however, like Shakespeare's Cleopatra, she is an object of exasperated hatred, and is thought to be deeply and desperately wicked. In portraying the heroine, the male author does not write from observation, but merely objectifies his own emotions. In regard to his other female characters, he is more objective, and may even depend upon his notebook. But when he is in love, his passion makes a mist between him and the object of his devotion. Women novelists, also, have two kinds of women in their books. One is themselves, glamorous and kind, and object of lust to the wicked, and of love to the good, sensitive, high-souled, and constantly misjudged. The other kind is represented by all other women, and is usually portrayed as petty, spiteful, cruel, and deceitful. It would seem that to judge women without bias is not easy either for men or for women. Generalizations about national characteristics are just as common and just as unwarranted as generalizations about women. Until 1870, the Germans were thought of as a nation of spectacle professors, evolving everything out of their inner consciousness, and scarcely aware of the outer world. But since 1870, this conception has had to be very sharply revised. Frenchmen seem to be thought of by most Americans as perpetually engaged in amorous intrigue. Walt Whitman, in one of his catalogues, speaks of the adulterous French couple on the sly settee. Americans who go to live in France are astonished, and perhaps disappointed, by the intensity of family life. Before the Russian Revolution, the Russians were credited with a mystical Slav soul, which, while it incapacitated them for ordinary sensible behavior, gave them a kind of deep wisdom to which more practical nations could not hope to attain. Suddenly everything was changed. Mysticism was taboo, and only the most earthly ideas were tolerated. The truth is that what appears to one nation as the national character of another depends upon a few prominent individuals, or upon the class that happens to have power. For this reason, all generalizations on this subject are liable to be completely upset by any important political change. To avoid the various foolish opinions to which mankind are prone, no superhuman genius is required. A few simple rules will keep you not from all error, but from silly error. If the matter is one that can be settled by observation, make the observation yourself. Aristotle could have avoided the mistake of thinking that women have fewer teeth than men by the simple device of asking Mrs. Aristotle to keep her mouth open while he counted. He did not do so because he thought he knew. Thinking that you know when in fact you don't is a fatal mistake, to which we are all prone. I believe myself that hedgehogs eat black beetles, because I have been told that they do. But if I were writing a book on the habits of hedgehogs, I should not commit myself until I had seen one enjoying this unappetizing diet. Aristotle, however, was less cautious. Ancient and medieval authors knew all about unicorns and salamanders. Not one of them thought it necessary to avoid dogmatic statements about them because he had never seen one of them. Many matters, however, are less easily brought to the test of experience. If, like most of mankind, you have passionate convictions on many such matters, there are ways in which you can make yourself aware of your own bias. If an opinion contrary to your own makes you angry, that is a sign that you are subconsciously aware of having no good reason for thinking as you do. If someone maintains that 2 and 2 are 5, or that Iceland is on the equator, you feel pity rather than anger, unless you know so little of arithmetic or geography that his opinion shakes your own contrary conviction. The most savage controversies are those about matters as to which there is no good evidence either way. Persecution is used in theology, not in arithmetic, because in arithmetic there is knowledge, but in theology there is only opinion. So whenever you find yourself getting angry about a difference of opinion, be on your guard. You will probably find on examination that your belief is going beyond what the evidence warrants. A good way of ridding yourself of certain kinds of dogmatism is to become aware of opinions held in social circles different from your own. When I was young, I lived much outside my own country in France, Germany, Italy, and the United States. I found this very profitable in diminishing the intensity of insular prejudice. If you cannot travel, seek out people with whom you disagree, and read a newspaper belonging to a party that is not yours. If the people and the newspaper seem mad, perverse, and wicked, remind yourself that you seem so to them. In this opinion, both parties may be right, but they cannot both be wrong. This reflection should generate a certain caution. Becoming aware of foreign customs, however, does not always have a beneficial effect. In the 17th century, when the Manchus conquered China, it was the custom among the Chinese for the women to have small feet, and among the Manchus for the men to wear pigtails. Instead of each dropping their own foolish customs, they adopted the foolish custom of the other, and the Chinese continued to wear pigtails until they shook off the dominion of the Manchus in the Revolution of 1911. For those who have enough psychological imagination, it is a good plan to imagine an argument with a person having a different bias. This has one advantage, and only one, as compared with actual conversation with opponents. This one advantage is that the method is not always subject to the same limitations of time or space. Mahatma Gandhi deplores railways and steamboats and machinery. He would like to undo the whole of the Industrial Revolution. He may never have the opportunity of actually meeting anyone who holds this opinion, because in Western countries, most people take the advantage of modern technique for granted. But if you want to make sure that you are right in agreeing with the prevailing opinion, you will find it a good plan to test the arguments that occur to you by considering what Gandhi might say in refutation of them. I have sometimes been led actually to change my mind as a result of this kind of imaginary dialogue, and, short of this, I have frequently found myself growing less dogmatic and cocksure through realizing the possible reasonableness of a hypothetical opponent. Be very wary of opinions that flatter your self-esteem. Both men and women, 9 times out of 10, are firmly convinced of the superior excellence of their own sex. There is abundant evidence on both sides. If you are a man, you can point out that most poets and men of science are male. If you are a woman, you can retort that so are most criminals. The question is inherently insoluble, but self-esteem conceals this from most people. We are all, whatever part of the world we come from, persuaded that our own nation is superior to all others. Seeing that each nation has its characteristic merits and demerits, we adjust our standard of values so as to make out that the merits possessed by our nation are the really important ones, while its demerits are comparatively trivial. Here again, the rational man will admit that the question is one to which there is no demonstrably right answer. It is more difficult to deal with the self-esteem of man as man, because we cannot argue out the matter with some non-human mind. The only way I know of dealing with this general human conceit is to remind ourselves that man is a brief episode in the life of a small planet in a little corner of the universe, and that, for aught we know, other parts of the cosmos may contain beings as superior to ourselves as we are to jellyfish. Other passions besides self-esteem are common sources of error. Of these, perhaps the most important is fear. Fear sometimes operates directly by inventing rumors of disaster in wartime, or by imagining objects of terror, such as ghosts. Sometimes it operates indirectly, by creating belief in something comforting, such as the elixir of life, or heaven for ourselves and hell for our enemies. Fear has many forms. Fear of death, fear of the dark, fear of the unknown, fear of the herd, and that vague generalized fear that comes to those who conceal from themselves their more specific terrors. Until you have admitted your own fears to yourself and have guarded yourself by a difficult effort of will against their myth-making power, you cannot hope to think truly about many matters of great importance, especially those with which religious beliefs are concerned. Fear is the main source of superstition, and one of the main sources of cruelty. To conquer fear is the beginning of wisdom, in the pursuit of truth, as in the endeavor after a worthy manner of life. There are two ways of avoiding fear. One is by persuading ourselves that we are immune from disaster, and the other is by the practice of sheer courage. The latter is difficult, and to everybody becomes impossible at a certain point. The former has therefore always been more popular. Primitive magic has the purpose of securing safety, either by injuring enemies or by protecting oneself by talismans, spells, or incantations. Without any essential change, belief in such ways of avoiding danger survived throughout the many centuries of Babylonian civilization, spread from Babylon throughout the Empire of Alexander, and was acquired by the Romans in the course of their absorption of the Hellenistic culture. From the Romans, it descended to medieval Christendom and Islam. Science has now lessened the belief in magic, but many people place more faith in mascots than they are willing to avow, and sorcery, while condemned by the Church, is still officially a possible sin. Magic, however, was a crude way of avoiding terrors, and, moreover, not a very effective way, for wicked magicians might always prove stronger than good ones. In the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, dread of witches and sorcerers led to the burning of hundreds of thousands convicted of these crimes. But newer beliefs, particularly as to the future life, sought more effective ways of combating fear. Socrates, on the day of his death, if Plato is to be believed, expressed the conviction that in the next world he would live in the company of the gods and heroes, and surrounded by just spirits, who would never object to his endless argumentation. Plato, in his Republic, laid it down that cheerful views of the next world must be enforced by the state, not because they were true, but to make soldiers more willing to die in battle. He would have none of the traditional myths about Hades, because they represented the spirits of the dead as unhappy. Orthodox Christianity in the ages of faith laid down very definite rules for salvation. First, you must be baptized. Then you must avoid all theological error. Last, you must, before dying, repent of your sins and receive absolution. All this would not save you from purgatory, but it would ensure your ultimate arrival in heaven. It was not necessary to know theology. An eminent cardinal stated authoritatively that the requirements of orthodoxy would be satisfied if you murmured on your deathbed, "I believe all that the Church believes. The Church believes all that I believe." These very definite directions ought to have made Catholics sure of finding the way to heaven. Nevertheless, the dread of hell persisted and has caused in recent times a great softening of the dogmas as to who will be damned. The doctrine professed by many modern Christians that everybody will go to heaven ought to do away with the fear of death. But in fact, this fear is too instinctive to be easily vanquished. F. W. H. Myers, whom spiritualism has converted to belief in a future life, questioned a woman who had lately lost her daughter as to what she supposed had become of her soul. The mother replied, "Oh, well, I suppose she is enjoying eternal bliss, but I wish you wouldn't talk about such unpleasant subjects." In spite of all that theology can do, heaven remains to most people an unpleasant subject. The most refined religions, such as those of Marcus Aurelius and Spinoza, are still concerned with the conquest of fear. The Stoic doctrine was simple. It maintained that the only true God is virtue, of which no enemy can deprive me. Consequently, there is no need to fear enemies. The difficulty was that no one could really believe virtue to be the only good, not even Marcus Aurelius, who, as emperor, sought not only to make his subjects virtuous, but to protect them against barbarians, pestilences, and famines. Spinoza taught a somewhat similar doctrine. According to him, our true good consists in indifference to our mundane fortunes. Both these men sought to escape from fear by pretending that such things as physical suffering are not really evil. This is a noble way of escaping from fear, but is still based upon false belief. And if genuinely accepted, it would have the bad effect of making men indifferent, not only to their own sufferings, but also to those of others. Under the influence of great fear, almost everybody becomes superstitious. The sailors who threw Jonah overboard imagined his presence to be the cause of the storm, which threatened to wreck their ship. In a similar spirit, the Japanese, at the time of the Tokyo earthquake, took to massacring Koreans and liberals. When the Romans won victories in the Punic Wars, the Carthaginians became persuaded that their misfortunes were due to a certain laxity which had crept into the worship of Moloch. Moloch liked having children sacrificed to him, and preferred them aristocratic, but the noble families of Carthage had adopted the practice of surreptitiously substituting plebeian children for their own offspring. This, it was thought, had displeased the god, and at the worst moments even the most aristocratic children were duly consumed in the fire. Strange to say, the Romans were victorious in spite of this democratic reform on the part of their enemies. Collective fear stimulates herd instinct and tends to produce ferocity towards those who are not regarded as members of the herd. So it was in the French Revolution, when dread of foreign armies produced the Reign of Terror. And it is to be feared that the Nazis, as defeat draws nearer, will increase the intensity of their campaign for exterminating Jews. Fear generates impulses of cruelty, and therefore promotes such superstitious beliefs as seem to justify cruelty. Neither a man nor a crowd nor a nation can be trusted to act humanely or to think sanely under the influence of a great fear. And for this reason, poltroons are more prone to cruelty than brave men, and are also more prone to superstition. When I say this, I am thinking of men who are brave in all respects, not only in facing death. Many a man will have the courage to die gallantly, but will not have the courage to say, or even think, that the cause for which he is asked to die is an unworthy one. Obloquy is, to most men, more painful than death. That is one reason why, in times of collective excitement, so few men venture to dissent from the prevailing opinion. No Carthaginian denied Moloch, because to do so would have required more courage than was required to face death in battle. But we have been getting too solemn. Superstitions are not always dark and cruel. Often they add to the gaiety of life. I received once a communication from the god Osiris, giving me his telephone number. He lived at that time in a suburb of Boston. Although I did not enroll myself among his worshippers, his letter gave me pleasure. I have frequently received letters from men announcing themselves as the Messiah, and urging me not to omit to mention this important fact in my lectures. During Prohibition, there was a sect which maintained that the communion service ought to be celebrated in whiskey, not in wine. This tenet gave them a legal right to a supply of hard liquor, and the sect grew rapidly. There is in England a sect which maintains that the English are the lost 10 tribes. There is a stricter sect which maintains that they are only the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Whenever I encounter a member of either of these sects, I profess myself an adherent of the other, and much pleasant argumentation results. I like also the men who study the Great Pyramid, with a view to deciphering its mystical lore. Many great books have been written on this subject, some of which have been presented to me by their authors. It is a singular fact that the Great Pyramid always predicts the history of the world accurately up to the date of publication of the book in question, but after that date it becomes less reliable. Generally, the author expects very soon wars in Egypt, followed by Armageddon and the coming of Antichrist. But by this time, so many people have been recognized as Antichrist that the reader is reluctantly driven to skepticism. I admire especially a certain prophetess who lived beside a lake in northern New York State about the year 1820. She announced to her numerous followers that she possessed the power of walking on water, and that she proposed to do so at 11 o'clock on a certain morning. At the stated time, the faithful assembled in their thousands beside the lake. She spoke to them, saying, "Are you all entirely persuaded that I can walk on water?" With one voice they replied, "We are." "In that case," she announced, "there is not need for me to do so." And they all went home much edified. Perhaps the world would lose some of its interest and variety if such beliefs were wholly replaced by cold science. Perhaps we may allow ourselves to be glad of the Abecedarians, who were so called because, having rejected all profane learning, they thought it wicked to learn the ABC. And we may enjoy the perplexity of the South American Jesuit, who wondered how the sloth could have travelled, since the flood, all the way from Mount Ararat to Peru, a journey which its extreme tardiness of locomotion rendered almost incredible. A wise man will enjoy the goods of which there is a plentiful supply, and of intellectual rubbish he will find an abundant diet, in our own age as in every other.